We had no idea that a company called Rocketdyne Propulsion and Power was dismantling old nuclear reactors and dumping the waste there, and that a disproportionate number of residents of the area were dying from a variety of different types of cancer, including our Skylar. It was in the air, it was in the water, it was in our homes. More than 200,000 people filed a class action suit against Rocketdyne, and Charisse and I hired an attorney to prepare a lawsuit of our own. Of course, that won't bring Skylar back. It won't even make us feel any better. But maybe it will influence corporations to act more responsibly and prevent someone else from going through what we did. I often imagine that Skylar is still with me, sitting next to me in the car or lying in a warm lump next to me on the bed. I guess that makes me crazy, but it also keeps me sane. Chapter 4. Mike Amato. A road manager, the longtime straight man to the buffoonery of our heroes, contemplates the future of a body without its head. Nikki and I were sitting on the floor of an elevator in London. It kept going up and down, up and down, up and... you get the picture. Nikki was saying, what am I going to do about John? What do I do with this kid? Do we bring Vince back? Do we fire John? I was sort of half joking, but we both hit on the same idea at the same time. Why don't we have two singers? We never spoke about it again.
Chapter 5. Nikki. Of the delectable conversation which passed between Motley Crue and the entertainment magnates whose good graces are essential to the well-being of our heroes. We fired everybody. Chuck Shapiro, the accountant who had stood by us for nearly 15 years, goodbye. Bob Rock, the producer responsible for our biggest hit and our biggest flop, so long. Doug Thaler, the manager who had been with us ever since we were L.A. fuck-ups pissing in cop cars, see ya. We blamed and fired everybody around us for our failure on the Karabi tour. It was the first time we failed, so, hey, it couldn't have been our fault. They were probably glad to get away from us by that point anyway, because we were the worst kind of band in the world, one that is on its way down and refuses to see it or stop it. As we were deciding which of 100 different directions to take our next album in, we hired a new manager named Alan Kovac because, frankly, we were impressed by his ruthlessness. He had brought Duran Duran back from the New Wave grave and had not only gotten Meatloaf his royalties back from Epic Records, but had also given him another hit. We told him that Motley Crue was a band with John Karabi as its singer and that we hoped he wasn't working with us under any other assumption. Of course, he promised, but in my heart I knew that the only reason he had agreed to manage us was so that he could get Karabi out of the band and bring Vince back. A few weeks later, Doug Morris, the CEO of Warner Music, which owned Elektra, called us to New York for a meeting. After all the millions of dollars we had generated for his company, this was the first time they had ever treated us with respect. On the day of the meeting, limos arrived at each of our houses and took us to a private airport, where the Warner's corporate G4 jet, which we'd never even been on before, was waiting for us on the runway. They hadn't invited Karabi to the meeting, but we figured it was just an oversight and brought him along instead of Mick, who wanted to stay home and watch Three Stooges reruns. Karabi and I boarded the plane and found Alan Kovac, his secretary, Tommy, and Pamela Anderson, who Tommy had just married in a whirlwind romance that had caught us all off guard. She was behaving strangely and refused to sit down. Instead, she lay on her back the whole time, mumbling incoherently and rolling around as if she were ill. While she did that, Tommy and I looked at downloads of bestiality pictures on our computers and tried to gross out Kovac's secretary. To us, everything seemed just great. Here we were with a new manager being fed shrimp cocktails and champagne on a corporate jet that was bringing us to a label that gave us $4.5 million every time we nodded our heads to do another record. We figured that Doug Morris wanted to give us some encouragement and say how proud he was of us for sticking to our guns despite a bungled tour and shakeups at the label. It seemed like finally our career was moving up again. We couldn't have been any stupider. The first thing that happened when we arrived at Warner's was that they wouldn't let Karabi up to Morris's office. They made him wait outside in the lobby with Kovac's secretary. The office probably cost as much as my home. It was covered with teak wood and fine art, and there was a piano from the 1800s sitting polished and proud in the corner. Morris sat in a plush velvet couch in front of a teak wood table, smoking a cigar that cost who knows how many hundreds of dollars. We walked in and sat across from him. There were four chairs set up for us, one for Tommy, one for me, one for Kovac, and one empty one. Morris was a very smart and subtle man. He leaned back into the velvet, looking very bald, round, and rich, then dropped his weight forward and fixed us with his eyes. "So," he began, exhaling a cloud of poisonous cigar gas, "we were thinking about what we should do." He paused and looked at the end of his cigar, as if debating whether to relight it or not. We sat there, unsure if we had just been asked a question we were supposed to respond to. Then he continued, "And what we should do is get rid of the guy who's not a star." He then went on to tell us about all the times he had given bands in our same situation ideas that had turned into hits. "I'll tell you what. Call the old guy. Bring him back. Everyone will love that. We'll put out a live record and get you guys on the road. Afterward, we'll set you up for a new studio album." He didn't even have the decency to mention John or Vince by their names. When we disagreed and tried to explain all the reasons why Vince was holding us back and how Karabi was much more in step with what was going on in rock music now, he cut us off. "We are done with this," he said curtly. "This is bullshit." I was about to lose it. I stood up and was beginning my usual "fuck you, we don't need you" rant when Morris's receptionist announced that Sylvia Roan was outside. Roan had taken Bob Krasnow's place as head of Elektra Records. She was the highest-ranking female in the record business, and from what we could tell, did not necessarily comprehend the deep philosophical and humanistic implications of songs like "Girls, Girls, Girls." But to our surprise, she stuck up for us. "They don't need Vince, Doug," she said. "They are great just as they are. They are very current with John. John is very current." "Yeah, yeah," we all began to chime in. "John has a more organic voice. What we did in the 80s was the 80s, but this is the 90s. It's a different time." "Absolutely," Roan parroted. "It's a different time." Morris stubbed out his cigar and looked at Sylvia. "Do you really think so?" "Absolutely," she said, even more convincingly. "Well then," he said, "I agree with Sylvia." I looked at Kovac excitedly. A meeting that had begun as a disaster was turning into a triumph, but Kovac didn't share my enthusiasm. His face looked clouded and concerned, a semaphore flashing a warning back at me. "I smell a rat." When we left the meeting, Kovac and I followed Sylvia down the hall and cornered her. "Do you really believe this?" Kovac asked her. "Because if you put out this next Motley record, you know that our contract obligates you to put a lot of label resources into promoting and marketing it. I think you know exactly how much money it's going to require, so I want to make sure this is serious." Roan kept nodding her head, saying, "Yeah, baby, yeah, yeah, absolutely, we'll do it." It didn't sound very convincing, especially when she kept looking at her watch. Finally, she cut him off. "Don't worry, it's in good hands," she said. "Now I have to go. I'm late for a meeting." "Okay," Kovac said, and we turned around, walked down the hall toward the exit, looked at each other, and both spoke the same words at the same time. "We're fucked." In the lobby, Karabi was hunched in his chair, wringing his hands and practically dripping with sweat. I smiled weakly at him and said, "You're in." He grinned weakly back, and we all walked outside and grabbed a cab. Kovac took the front seat and turned back to Karabi angrily. "You are not a star," he told him. and we are in fucking hell. You've got to get it together. The rest of you guys have got to make the greatest album of your entire lives right now, because if you don't, we are dead in the water. There is no way that woman is going to promote this record. We are a tax write-off, a loss. I can smell it. She set us up. Doug Morris had reached out a hand to save us from drowning, and Sylvia Roan had walked right in, kicked his hand away, and sent us tumbling back into the depths. In the weeks that followed, we kept asking her for money to start the new record. She'd give us a little, and we'd start recording. But the money would suddenly dry up, and we'd have to stop. It seemed like she was trying to squeeze and demoralize us, probably because she had inherited a contract from her predecessor that required her to pay huge sums to a band that, as far as she was concerned, was washed up. If we broke up, then our contract was void and the money could be redirected toward the singers and bands she supported. What came next was the sound of a lot of pride being swallowed. Fat from the success of Dr. Feelgood, and with prodding from my wife Brandy, whose materialism seemed to increase in direct proportion to the waning of our love, I had bought a full-on drug dealer mansion. My overhead expenses were $40,000 a month. That's how much it costs just to wake up and go to sleep every day between my house payments and utilities bills. It cost $2,500 in electricity just to cool the house each month, plus I'd insist on keeping my pool heated to 95 degrees year-round. When Tommy and I found ourselves paying for the album out of our own pockets, Mick was long since broke, thanks to Emmy, those things started to matter. At the same time, my third child was being born. Every time Brandy and I came close to separating, another child would pop out to keep us together. And Vince and Charisse's only daughter, Skylar, was dying. I suddenly became aware that everything in life didn't always turn out okay. Life was full of traps, and my future, my happiness, and Motley Crue were all caught fast in them. Tommy and I decided to co-produce the album at his house with a guy named Scott Humphrey, who had done some engineering work with Bob Rock on Feel Good. What we needed was someone to tell us we were fooling ourselves trying to make some sort of electro-grunge record with Corabi. But that someone wasn't Scott Humphrey, an engineer very skilled at a computer studio program called Pro Tools. Humphrey had never produced a band before. He would sit me down and say, "You wrote all the great Motley Crue songs. I don't want Tommy writing songs. He thinks he can write, but all he does is listen to whoever is in that week and copy them. His lyrics have nothing to do with what Motley Crue is all about." Then Scott would pull Tommy aside and whisper in his ear, "Nicky is outdated. He's still stuck in the 80s. You need to be doing the songwriting. You need to be using drum loops and techno beats and bringing the music up to date. You know what's going on." He was completely incapable of dealing with these two giant egos that were Tommy and me. Whoever was in the room, that's whose ass he'd kiss. Except for Mick, who had no ego. Scott started convincing us that Mick was a bad guitarist. When Mick would leave, Scott would pull me aside and make me play something on guitar. Then he'd make a loop of it, put it through some noise filters, and replace Mick's playing. So for the first time in our careers, we started to turn against Mick, to think that he was actually the one holding us back because he thought that the blues and classic rock were the only genres of music that mattered. Pretty soon, Motley Crue was a wildly schizophrenic beast, making some monstrosity that sounded like the Beatles mixed with all these fifth and third Alice in Chains harmonies. We had no idea what we were doing. I guess that's why we decided to call the album, our ninth, Personality Number 9. Though the gonzo writer Hunter S. Thompson later inspired us to change it to Generation Swine. Eventually, we moved into my drug dealer mansion. We set up the drums in my oak-walled office, the mixing desk in the bathroom, and the Marshall stacks along the marble hallways, while my three children terrorized us, and Brandy screamed at me with the regularity of an alarm clock with a snooze button. I'd keep turning her off, but 10 minutes later she'd be blaring in my ear again. In the meantime, Tommy and I continued to work in two completely separate directions. Mick was being brainwashed into believing that he had nothing to contribute to the band, and Corabi was being treated like a criminal who had stolen our careers. Every day, we'd take all our frustrations out on him. We'd tell him that he needed to cut his hair, or that he needed to sing in a completely different style. And every week, we'd change our minds about everything. We were trying too hard to make a great album, but we had no idea what great was supposed to be anymore because we were too scared to be ourselves. Finally, one day, Karabi told us that he'd had enough. "I'm not a singer," he complained. "I'm a guitar player. I can't do this anymore." So now we had two guitar players and no singer. We were completely turned around. And that's when Kovac, lurking quietly in the background, sprang on us.
Chapter 6. Tommy. A 4.5-year separation is brought to a swift and lucrative end, though not to everyone's liking. I was so fucking dead set against meeting with Vince when Kovac brought it up, and so was fucking Nicky, who, little punk that he is, walked into the meeting wearing a t-shirt that had John written in big motherfucking letters on it. But the lawyers and managers tricked us and told us that if we just met with Vince, he'd drop the lawsuit. They set up a secret meeting in a suite at the Hyatt off the 405 freeway. Nicky and I walked in with two big-ass attorneys and found Vince chilling in an armchair with his manager and two other attorneys. It was like fucking Millionaire Divorce Court or something. Their plan was not only for Vince to end the lawsuit, but for all of us to start recording together and being a band again. All these greasy fucking people wanted their money, and they didn't give a shit about us or our happiness. It was like Motley plus Vince equals cash. Motley minus Vince equals no cash. Vince had grown so fucking big since I last saw him that he looked like Roseanne Barr or something. His head was the size of a balloon and folds of fat were billowing over his watch. He was wearing blue slacks with a short-sleeved dress shirt tucked in, and his body was a weird yellowy shade of brown that was probably a combination of liver problems from alcohol and sunburn from lazing around all day in Hawaii. It was about 4 p.m., and I was willing to bet my fucking tits that he was plastered. I don't think he really wanted to see us either, but he was practically broke between his daughter's death, his leaving his deal with Warner Brothers, the breakup of his solo band, his divorce, and the millions of dollars he owed on his Simi Valley home after Charisse practically destroyed the place with parties. "I don't want anything to do with this guy," Nicky whispered to me. "If you want to know what uncool is, all you have to do is look at him." Nicky and I tried to be nice. I said something like, "Good to finally see you again, dude," which I didn't mean. And when he piped off like only Vince can and said something snide like, "Sure you are, buddy," Nicky and I hit the roof. "Fuck you, we're out of here," Nicky said and grabbed my arm. All the fucking attorneys reached for us with their greasy little hands like we were million-dollar checks walking into an incinerator. "No!" they yelled. "It took too long to get you guys together." "I'm going," Nicky snapped at them. "I don't need this fat piece of shit who looks like some reject from a Florida retirement community." Two attorneys grabbed Nicky and brought him in another room to calm down while the other two worked on Vince. It was like we were marionettes that had somehow rebelled and started thinking for themselves. They wanted us to be good marionettes and let them pull all the right strings. "If Nicky says one more word, I'm gonna knock him out," Vince seethed with rage. None of us ever apologized, even after 2 hours of bullshitting. We told Vince that we had an album that was almost done, but we didn't have a singer. Our managers, Kovac for us and Bert Stein for Vince, kept trying to steer us closer and closer together, their collective slobber increasing as they realized that their cash cow might be producing fucking milk again. By the end of the meeting, I began to cool off and even come around to the idea a little. When a band that's been together for 15 years changes the main element, some people are going to get freaked out. I used to do interviews where I said we'd fucking break up if any one of us left the band because it wouldn't be Motley Crue anymore. So I understood why it was necessary, though in my heart I was happy with where we were going with John. Before we left, we scheduled the time for Vince to stop by the studio, promising to leave our baggage outside the front door. Though Karabi had officially stepped down from the band, we continued to work with him in the studio. On a Sunday, when Karabi wasn't scheduled to come in, Vince arrived. In my head, I kept repeating, "This is wrong, this is wrong, this is wrong." But I didn't say a word because all our crystal-clear resentments and issues were supposed to be left on the doorstep, which I doubted was big enough to hold all that baggage. I tried to accept the fact that Motley Crue was four people: Nicky, Mick, Vince, and Tommy. With that in mind, the first thing we did was start removing Karabi's voice on each song so that Vince could re-sing them. After Vince left the studio that night, I called Karabi and took him out for sushi. I was fully crying. "Dude," I said as tears rolled down my cheeks, "I can't believe this is happening. They're really going to let you go." Karabi had given them an excuse to bring Vince back, and they had seized the opportunity and left him in the dust. I don't think he really wanted to leave the band. He liked singing with us, but he just couldn't take the contradictory pressures we were putting on him in the studio. He thought that at least he'd be able to stay on as a second guitarist and singer. "I'm sorry," I told him for the 10th time that evening. "I'm only a quarter of this machine. Fucking majority rules, and the powers that be are making it happen. I just want you to know that this isn't what I wanted." It was a heavy day, dude.
Chapter 7 John Karabi, in which a replacement is replaced by the person he replaced. I think I first sensed that something was up when we ended our tour in Japan. For some reason, everywhere these guys went, disaster followed them like a black cloud. I was never in trouble before I joined the band, but now it was fistfights, drama, and police practically every day. Our Japanese promoter, Mr. Udo, shook in his patent leather shoes the minute he saw us. Evidently, he had had some experience with the band prior to me. By the end of the tour, between the destroyed hotel rooms, Nicky inviting thousands of fans to stampede the stage every night, and worst of all, Tommy deciding to be funny by playing "You Dropped the Bomb on Me" as the intro to our Hiroshima show, Mr. Udo was ordering not one kamikaze, but a whole pitcher of them for himself every night. His hands were shaking so hard I was sure that the moment we left, he was going to check himself into a sanitarium. After our last night at Budokan, I left Mr. Udo shaking at the hotel bar with his pitcher of kamikazes, went to the Lexington Queen, and got good and rotted. There was a big board on the wall announcing the dates that different American and British bands would be in town so that all the young models would show up. I noticed that the Vince Neil band was playing in Tokyo the following week. "Oh shit," I blurted. "Vince Neil is going to be here." I was with a tall, twig-thin Hungarian model with brown hair who I had met that night. "I know," she replied. "I'm going to the show." So jokingly I told her, "Well, if you get to meet him, tell him I said hi." At about 3 a.m. we went back to her place. There were 3 rooms, 12 beds, and 11 of her model roommates running around drunk and naked. Guys they had picked up, lines of coke, and used condoms were lying around everywhere. It was one of the sickest but most exciting scenes I had ever seen. So I fucked the chick and 2 of her friends. I was in Motley Crue, after all. I had a reputation to live up to. And left the next morning to catch my plane. A week later, I was sitting at home and my phone rang. It was the Hungarian model and she was pissed. "Are you trying to make a dummy of me?" she asked. "What?" "Vince Neil came into the Lexington Queen after the show, and I said, 'Hi, how are you doing? John Karabi wanted me to say hello to you.' And Vince said, 'Who?' So I said to him, 'John Karabi, the singer from Motley Crue, said for me to tell you hello.' And then he became so mad." "What did he do?" "He said to me, 'I'm the singer from Motley Crue.' Then he called me a whore. Then he threw a beer bottle at me. Then he told me to get out of the club. Then he threw another beer bottle at me. I think he was drunk." That right there should have clued me into the fact that Vince still considered himself the singer of Motley Crue and me an interloper whose time had come. When we started recording again, the plan was to return to our roots with a raw, straight-ahead rock and roll record. We started writing songs with Bob Rock called "The Year I Lived in a Day" and "La Dolce Vita." And at the end of each day, we'd walk around carrying our huge cocks in our hands because the music rocked so hard. But all of a sudden, things started getting funny. Nicky and Tommy flipped out and fired everybody, including Bob Rock, because he was too expensive and overproduced the music, they said. So Tommy, Nicky, and Scott Humphrey decided to produce together, which was somewhat of an ego trip for Nicky and Tommy. Working with this three-headed producer, I soon started tearing my hair out. The songs would change every day. Tommy and Scott would adjust some effects on the drums, which would alter the drum pattern completely, which would require the bass and guitar parts to be changed, which would require Nikki to write new lyrics. Then I'd come in to sing the tune I'd been rehearsing off our demo tapes for a week, and it wouldn't even be the same song anymore. They'd stick me in the booth anyway and say, "Just see what you can come up with." So I'd sit in there at Nikki's house, where half the equipment wasn't even wired up properly, and get so flustered trying to please them. Nikki would jump on the intercom and say, "Crab, I'm kind of thinking of an old Bowie, Sisters of Mercy kind of vibe." Then Scott would hit the button and add, "But with a little Cheap Trick, Nine Inch Nails kind of thing." Finally, Tommy would chime in, "Yeah, but make it lush like Oasis." So I'd start trying to figure all this out, then Tommy would interrupt again and say, "Oh yeah, dude, I forgot to add that the track's gotta be heavy like Pantera." I had no clue what these guys were saying to me. None at all. I'd beg them to sing something to give me an idea of what they were hearing, but they wouldn't. They'd just say, "It's hard to explain, but what you just sang ain't it." After weeks of this, Tommy, who'd always been my biggest supporter, said, "Dude, what the fuck do you do when you go home? You suck." I was devastated. 2 years ago, if I farted, these guys thought it was the greatest sound they had ever heard. Now, I was the shittiest singer in the world in their eyes. It felt like a relationship in which a girlfriend knows she wants her freedom, but she doesn't want to hurt your feelings. So instead, she just gets moody, critical, and mean, hoping to drive you away. If the time we spent recording Motley Crue in Vancouver was the best year of my life, this was fast becoming the worst. Besides not getting along with the guys at all, my mother passed away. She had been sick for 2 years with cancer, and her health insurance and Social Security weren't coming through at all. So I sold my Harley and anything else I could to help pay her bills. In desperation, I even borrowed money from an uncle in Philadelphia on the condition that when I received my first publishing advance for the new Motley record, I'd pay him back. I had also just moved in with my girlfriend, a confused model named Robin, who I was madly in love with. But everything started to go wrong between us. She wasn't sure what she wanted to do with her life, and would sit around at home all day taking out her frustrations by browbeating me. In the meantime, my son was in and out of the hospital because of his diabetes. It seemed like my entire support system, my mother, my girlfriend, my son, my best friends, and my band was collapsing. I was locked in a room watching the walls around me fall down one by one. Every day, things kept getting weirder with Motley. We had a meeting in New York with some big shot guy at our label, and at the 11th hour, he wouldn't let me in the door. So they left the meeting blaming me for not being a star, whatever that is. No one can make themselves into a star. Your fans are the people who make you a star. Just look at all the unlikely characters who have become sex symbols simply by being popular. Nonetheless, they said that I had to start voice training, take choreography lessons, and get a stylist because I wasn't on par with the rest of the band. They wanted to do just about everything short of enrolling me in the Fame School. A week after the meeting, I was supposed to make an appearance with the band at the opening of the Hard Rock Casino in Las Vegas. Though I was broke and fighting constantly with Robin, we decided the trip would be good for us and bought new outfits for the event. But the day before, Nikki called and said not to bother. The casino hadn't left passes for me, he said, because they wanted only the more high-profile members of the band. Those words still sting to this day, because it wasn't too long ago that they made sure I was included in everything and insisted that Motley Crue was a democracy in which everyone had equal standing. I dreaded going into the studio every day to be reminded that I was inferior and useless. Then I dreaded going home afterward to be reminded of the same thing by my girlfriend. One day, I finally snapped. After hours of being told I was singing the wrong way, I picked up a guitar and came up with some chords that helped tie the song Confessions together for Tommy. He was so excited. "Crab," he beamed. "That's amazing. It's perfect, dude." I turned around and cracked. "Maybe I should just be a fucking guitar player then. At least I can do that right in your eyes." He laughed and I laughed, and I didn't think much about it until the next day. I walked into the studio, and the whole band was sitting there with our new manager, Alan Kovac. "Crab," Nikki said, "I can't believe you said that. You really want to give up singing to be a guitar player?" I told them that the comment had been sarcastic, but I think they had been waiting for me to quit the whole time. Even if I was only kidding, it was enough. A few weeks later, I went out to shoot some pool and drink beer with Tommy. We talked about the next album and the next tour, and how we could find the middle ground between who we were and who we wanted to be. Everything seemed normal. The next day, I went into the studio and they sprang another one of their meetings on me. After my night out with Tommy, I was ready for a discussion about what we were going to do for the album and tour. But it was Friday the 13th of September. Kovac broke the news. "Look, this is the deal," he said. "The record company is not going to promote anything that this band does unless we have the original lineup. End of story. I want you to know that this has nothing to do with you and is nothing against you. I don't give a shit if Paul McCartney is singing for this band. They want nothing to do with it, so we are going to bring Vince back into the fold." I was crushed, but at the same time, I was relieved. No longer would I have to face feeling inadequate and completely unwelcome at the hands of the Olympic browbeating team of Scott, Nicky, and Tommy. The nightmare was over. Oddly, even then the band couldn't agree. Nicky came over and said he was sorry, but they had to do it because they just couldn't get what they needed from me in the studio. Then Tommy took me out for sushi and said that it had nothing to do with the band or the record label, but that it was Kovac's fault. He said he wanted to see me stay in the band as a fifth member and guitar player, but I knew that wouldn't happen. Oddly enough, a few days afterward, the guys started calling me to come into the studio, saying they couldn't get anything out of Mick, and wondering if I could lay down some guitar tracks in the morning before Vince arrived. I did that for a few days until Mick called the studio one afternoon and asked, "Crab, what are you doing there?" "I'm just playing some guitar," I told him, and he went ballistic. Evidently, they hadn't told him they were bringing me in to redo his tracks. At one awkward point, they even called me in to teach Vince my vocal part on a song called "Kiss the Sky." It was a strange breakup because I became the only guy they could turn to when they had problems with the vocals or when Vince and Tommy were fighting. One day, Tommy or Nicky, I can't remember which, called after a blow-up and told me, "I will never ever do another album with Mick Mars or Vince Neil again." After a few weeks, the phone calls dwindled. Then they just stopped completely. My services weren't needed anymore. Coincidentally or not, shortly after Motley let me go, my girlfriend Robin told me that it wasn't going to work between us and moved out. 4 days later, a mutual friend called and told me that he had just returned from her wedding. She married a video director, a guy I had never even heard of before. For my own sanity, I assumed, and will continue to assume, that she met him after we broke up. I crawled into a dark hole in my mind. Between my girlfriend, my mother, my son, and my former band, I couldn't figure out what I had done wrong to deserve all this. I drove to my ex-wife's house to be with my son and collapsed on the couch, running through every moment of my life like a bad movie script. My son was watching television, and suddenly he turned to me, jumped into my lap, and hugged me, snapping me out of my self-pity. "Thanks for coming over and watching TV with me, Dad," he said. "I love you." I smiled and told him that I loved him too. Then I told myself that none of this other shit mattered. My son loved me. If I could rewind the years and relive all my experiences with Motley Crue, I wouldn't change a thing about the first half, meeting them, recording the album in Vancouver, running around the country on our promo tour. But in the second half, recording that second album, I would probably do a few things differently. First of all, I would definitely fight back. Secondly, and most importantly, I would tell them what I really wanted to tell them at the time, but never had the balls to. I was too scared of getting fired, so I kept my mouth shut and never spoke those 5 words that were burning a hole through my lips. Chapter 8. John Corabi. In which an erstwhile Motley Crue singer, after years of silence, discloses what he really wanted to say to the band during his final years of tribulation. "Make your fucking minds up."
Chapter 9. Vince. In which a head is returned to its body. Alan Kovac was a sneaky little bastard. And I mean that in the best sense of the word bastard, because I am probably a father to many. I was in Manhattan with my manager, Bert Stein, doing press for what would be my last solo tour, when we ran into Kovac in our hotel lobby. Kovac, who convincingly made his presence there seem like an accident, invited us up to his room to talk and order room service. He sat Bert and me down and began a sales pitch. "Vince, you can get as angry as you want with me, but you have to ask yourself, are you a star as a solo artist?" I answered him with a glare that signified neither yes nor no, but hatred. "I'll go on," he went on. "In the environment of four guys in a group called Motley Crue, you are a real star. And the audience that comes to see you gets its money's worth. Is the audience that comes to see the Vince Neil Band really getting what it pays to see?" He went on and on and on until I began to realize that he saw the big picture. And the big picture was that I wasn't going to make it on my own as a solo artist, and Motley Crue weren't going to make it on their own as an alternative rock band. I asked him if he had discussed this with Nicky or Tommy, and he said that they didn't know a thing, but that he could help make it happen. Before the meeting, I didn't really want to be back in Motley Crue. I just wanted to bury the hatchet, get the quarter share of the brand name I deserved, and move on. But with his bullshit, Kovac fertilized a seed that just kept growing. When months later I saw Nicky and Tommy at the Hyatt, we eventually came around to the idea that we needed to be together and that the rest of this stuff, the lawyers, the name-calling, the suing, was ridiculous. My lawyer bills alone already added up to $350,000, and they were sure to double if I continued the lawsuit. So by the end of the meeting, I told my lawyers, "We want to get this thing back together again. You guys do whatever it takes to get it done, and if you don't, you're fired." A week later, I went to Nicky's house, where they were recording the album, and heard some of the tracks. Oddly, Nicky and I started to get very close very quickly. But Tommy, ever since he married Heather, thought he was a movie star. And now that he was married to Pamela Anderson, it was even worse. He thought he was better than everybody else, and he made it very clear that I was back in the band against his will. There were a few times when he was so condescending that I said, "Fuck you guys. Go ahead and make a record without me. I don't give a shit." Maybe he was jealous of Nicky's friendship with me. I didn't know what it was. I never heard the album they did with Karabi, but a few weeks after I started recording with them again, Karabi stopped by. We drank a couple of beers and bullshitted for a while. He said that he was glad I was back in the band because the last year had been rough on him. And I surprised myself because I actually liked him. He was a pretty cool guy. After a week of recording, most of us started feeling pretty stupid. Everything sounded right. Everything sounded like Motley. We were a band again, and that was how it was supposed to be. Even Tommy seemed to be accepting his fate, and begrudgingly at first, liking the songs. Everyone was happy, except for Mick, who seemed ready to lay down his guitar and quit the band.
Chapter 10. Mick. Of important matters concerning dinosaurs, Komodo dragons, baseball caps, and the proper method of shooting women. Who or what killed the dinosaurs? My belief is that it was the Ebola virus, a virus that we are told is as old as the Earth itself. Since it is a flesh-eating virus, it could easily jump from host to host without any problem whatsoever, which would explain why the dinosaurs disappeared so suddenly and completely. The virus can consume most of a living being's flesh, organs, blood vessels, and brain tissue within 5 to 10 days, causing a crash and bleed out in which the organs liquefy and leak out of every orifice. This deadly virus is a more likely culprit than a meteor shower as far as wiping out the dinosaurs, but leaving the Earth intact for later inhabitants. And speaking of dinosaurs, what yuppie asshole decided that they should be depicted in all these bright, brilliant colors? Was it Martha Stewart? Clearly we have reconstructed dinosaurs from bones, so there is no evidence that they were the colors of kids' toys. Look at the Komodo dragon. There are no colors on that particularly poisonous descendant of dinos. If dinosaurs were really colored so brightly, they wouldn't have been able to stalk their prey effectively or hide from predators. I think about dinosaurs a lot, ever since I was made to feel like one when Karabi left the band. But instead of the Ebola virus, I had Scott Humphrey, the great invalidator. He invalidated Karabi out of the group. When he was through with Karabi, he went to work on me. It felt like he was always pushing his shortcomings off on other people. With every new song we started writing in the studio, I'd take the tape home and work up new parts until 2 in the morning. Then I'd come in the next day, play them, and the great invalidator would say, nope. I'd ask him if he knew what he wanted me to play, and he'd say, nope. I'd ask him if he knew what key the song was in, and he'd say, nope. Every sound I ever brought in on guitar was greeted with the chorus of nope, 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 nope. The great invalidator was making me look bad to Tommy and Nicky, making it look like I wasn't bringing anything to the table. He had them convinced that it was me who was holding the band back with my dinosaur rock guitar playing and my love of blues and Hendrix, which I guess were out of style or something. I wanted to remind them that I had named the band, that I had molded Nicky into a real songwriter, that I had purged the band's weak links, and that I had handpicked Vince. But, like always, I kept my mouth shut. If there's one thing I've learned, it's that overconfidence is the same thing as arrogance. And arrogant, egotistical people are the weakest, most feeble-minded people ever. If you've got it, you don't have to flaunt it. Egotistical people are, in my opinion, the most incompetent losers to walk the face of the earth since the pea-brained Brontosaurus. Certain people in that studio had a problem with arrogance, and in order to maintain their confidence, had to push their problems onto other people, which is why I was ready to quit. How many times do you have to hear no before you start believing it yourself? I was really becoming convinced that I was no good as a guitarist, that maybe instead of kicking Karabi out, they should have booted me. Then they could have Vince as a singer and Karabi as a guitarist, and they'd all be happy. But if I had left, the great invalidator would probably have started working on Nicky next and driven him out of the band. That guy, Scott Humphrey, didn't know what he wanted. On Dr. Feelgood, his job was to move stuff around on Pro Tools and pitch shift vocals. That's what he was good for. But now he was starting to believe he was a musician. I wanted to say, then write a song, prick. I'd never been so upset during my entire time with the band. He would even tell Tommy that he was a better guitarist than me, or he'd have Nicky, who's a bassist, playing my guitar parts. I bought stacks of books on invalidation, trying to figure out how I could survive this experience and still have the confidence to play on stage. The last straw came when the great invalidator called a big powwow with the management company. The reason for the meeting? My hat. He said he didn't like the baseball cap that I wore every day. It was a problem for him. That's how fucked up this asshole was. Then he told the whole management company that I wasn't bringing anything to the table. So what? I finally snapped. Why don't you just get rid of me then? I was ready to join John Karabi. Maybe we could start a blues band or something. There are only two occasions when I write. The first is when I have an idea about politics or the world. That can be anything from different ways of thinking about major events, like what if the Titanic actually struck the iceberg intentionally because, with a world war looming, Captain Smith was under secret orders to test out then-new high-carbon steel plates and watertight cabins, to just random thoughts about how stupid people are. For example, fat people who insist on wearing red, even though they always look like jolly old Saint Nick. The other reason I write is when I'm pissed off, and after that bullshit meeting, I was pissed off. Dear Nicky, I've been with you for so many years, playing guitar on every one of our hits. Suddenly it seems that I can't play guitar anymore. Let's see what's changed between then and now. What's different? There's only one element I can see that is different, and that's Scott Humphrey. You have excluded me in all the songwriting because you don't want it to be guitar-oriented. You haven't been happy with anything I've tried to contribute, and you've replaced all my playing on the record. It seems to me that the only thing you haven't done is replace me in the band. Maybe Scott Humphrey could come in and play guitar, since he told Tommy he's so much better than me anyway. So now I leave it in your hands. Have I gotten worse as a guitarist, or have you gotten worse as a judge of character? Your friend and bandmate, Bob Deal. I'm not great with words or anything, so that letter was the best I could do as far as talking to them and telling them what was really going on. Scott had his nose so far up Nicky and Tommy's asses that they couldn't even see the shit all over his face. After the letter, we had another one of our famous meetings, and I told the band that it was my last album, because I couldn't work with them anymore. But I guess that I had turned into an old broken-down coward. Where I really had been ready to leave the band when they were being assholes because I was dating Emmy on the girls' tour, now I was a little too scared to go through with it. What else was I going to do? I saw what happened to Vince on his own, and I'd seen a dozen other bands where a guy splits off and it doesn't work out for him. There was nothing else for me to do but be the guitarist in Motley Crue, even if that meant just hanging in and taking the abuse. So every day after the studio, I'd bitch to John Corabi, who, after his latest woman problems, was staying in my guest house again. Then we'd drive out to the woods and let off steam by target shooting. Before he left the band, he had met a couple of strippers and invited them to go shooting with us. We drove with them past Lancaster and into the open desert. We put on our safety goggles, gloves, and earplugs and ran into two local sheriffs who were admiring my guns. One of them grabbed a plate of steel, set it up 25 yards away, and said, "Here, shoot this." He had been shooting at it all day with a .22 and wanted to see what would happen with a bigger gun. It was tilted upward, and I nailed it right in the center. As I did, I heard a voice behind me yell, "Ouch!" It was John's date. "A bee just stung me," she whined. But I knew what had happened. A tiny piece of copper shrapnel from the bullet jacket had ricocheted off the plate, whizzed past my face, and hit her in the side. "That wasn't a bee," I told her. I pried her hand off her stomach, and blood came squirting out. I cleaned the wound, which was only a superficial cut, about 1/16 of an inch wide. The piece of shrapnel was the size of a fingernail, but I had enough experience with people like her to know that if I didn't take care of her, she would sue my ass off. I drove her to the hospital in my car while John held her hand, and she said she'd be fine and promised not to sue. I brought her home from the hospital and told her I'd pay the medical bills, get her plastic surgery so there'd be no scars, and make sure everything was taken care of. On the way back to my house, I apologized to Corabi. "That's all right," he said. "She was a bitch anyways." While she was in the hospital, hundreds of lawyers called her. Suddenly, she was claiming she was disfigured and that this 16th-inch scar had ruined her promising career as an exotic dancer. She became as greedy an enemy as an ex-wife, claiming that Corabi and I had been drinking and smoking pot that day, which was bullshit. I ended up paying her something like $10,000 out of court, which was just about all I had left in my name. She probably used the money to get her tits fixed or something. When the story about the lawsuit leaked out, the newspapers reported that I had gone out and purposely shot my girlfriend. That's why I never trust what I read. Believe me, if I was going to shoot somebody, it wouldn't be in the side of the stomach. It would be one shot to the head. Fuck body shots. Chapter 11. Scott Humphrey. A brief interlocution in which a much-discussed producer speaks for himself. What were your first impressions on working with the band?
They are, you know, very unique people. At first, it was a cool thing to be working with them because there was always drama. When I first met them, the drama was kind of fun, and I loved watching Tommy play his drums, just breaking cymbals in half and busting his drumsticks right and left. But then all of a sudden I was sitting in the producer's chair and it was impossible to get anyone, except Mick, to show up on time. After a while, we instituted a system of fines, $100 for each hour someone was late. Then it was another struggle to separate everyone from their pagers and cell phones. Days were just wasted without any work getting done. Things got worse once we moved into Nikki's gated mansion. Every day, Nikki would have to duck out of recordings to deal with the gardener or the pool guy or the fish lady or the car detailer or the maids who came twice a day to do the breakfast and evening dishes and chores. There was no end to the number of people working to keep that house standing.
One of the things I'd like to talk to you about is Mick's hat.
Mick's hat? What?
He said that you called a meeting with management to complain about his hat.
This definitely confirms some of the stuff I've heard out of Mick Mars's mouth, because that is ludicrous.
So you never had a problem with his hat?
That is just not possible. Mick Mars always wears a hat, except for when he's on stage sometimes. But who gives a shit whether he wears a hat or not?
Mick's not one to just make something up, though.
I'm sure if it happened, no one else remembers it but Mick. I think it's kind of weird. In fact, you know what? He used to always wear this Motley Crue racing hat, and I loved it. I said, "Hey, Mick, can you get me one of those?" And months later, he got me one. I'm looking in my closet now because I think I still have it. I was fixated on his hat because I wanted one, not because I didn't like it. Here it is. I found it. I'm blowing the dust off it now. It's got a skull and bones and racing flags on it. It's a black leather hat. I remember this distinctly now. He must have gotten it all wrong. The hat was all good. What was not good must have been something else.
Well, he did feel like you were invalidating him as a guitarist.
That really didn't have anything to do with me. Tommy and Nicky both liked the way that John Corabi played guitar, and they were always encouraging John to play. As the producer, you want to be very open and let everyone bring their parts to the table. But Mick just didn't want anyone playing the guitar. He'd scream out, "I'm the guitar player!" It's like, okay, you are the guitar player, but two other guys in your band want to hear John Corabi play. Sometimes the sound of two different guitar players playing the same part is a nice sound, like with AC/DC. It's funny that he would remember me being the guy who didn't want his guitar parts because I wanted to make a Motley Crue record that sounded like the early stuff. What I really liked was pure Mick Mars' raw guitar. In fact, I was always encouraging Mick, and he would bring me these cassettes called table scraps, which were bits and pieces of things he was working on at home. What really used to make this band work well was Mick writing guitar riffs and Nicky writing things over the top of them and Vince singing it all. That was the formula. Most of the riffs we were working on were based on John Corabi guitar parts, and those were these bluesy Zeppelin guitar riffs, so it was almost like the Motley Crue writing machine had shut down. Corabi probably hated me from the get-go because jamming was something he had brought to the band, and I wanted them to get back to writing songs again.
So you were the one who wanted to make a raw Motley record, and the rest of the guys wanted to sound more up-to-date?
Exactly. Nicky wanted to be Nine Inch Nails one day and U2's Zooropa the next day. Nicky and I were always going at it. We had argument after argument over lyric content. Nicky didn't like to have his lyrics scrutinized. There was this line in this song called Glitter that went, "Let's make a baby inside of you," and I was like, "There is no way. You can't put that line on this record." It was ridiculous, and he basically tried to say that it was the best thing he'd ever written. What kinds of things did Nicky say about me?
I think he felt like you were getting into head games and playing him off against Tommy. He said he needed a stronger producer to tell him he was full of shit sometimes.
Really? I think that most people would remember me being the guy who kept saying, "Quit trying to be Trent Reznor, just fucking sit down with a guitar and write songs." All I was trying to do was get a hit. I didn't care about anything but selling records. After all the time and grief and drama we all put in, the least we could have was a hit.
I think the band thought that in your mind, nothing was ever good enough.
That is the way I felt. The record sounds like a bit of a mishmash, and that it didn't sell is proof that it wasn't good enough.
Did Vince's return make things any easier?
No. The songs weren't written toward Vince's singing style or even his range. So even more so at that point, we needed fucking Mick to do what he did and unite the band. They were so good when they worked together as a band instead of as a bunch of fucking dysfunctional partners. With John, the problem was that his voice was always blown out. With Vince, there was an entirely different set of problems. We had what we used to call the Vince Neil window of opportunity. It was between beer 3 and beer 6. That was where he'd be warmed up after the hangover, but not so drunk that he couldn't even stand. And the window could close really fast. Sometimes we'd only have half an hour or 20 minutes with Vince, and if you asked him to sing more than a couple of times, he'd be like, "Fuck you," and he'd leave. My impression of Vince was to hold up my wrist and look at my watch. He didn't want to be in the recording studio. He'd rather be on the golf course.
So even when he was back, he didn't act like he was part of the band?
I think there was a jealousy because Nicky and Tommy were co-producing the record and he wanted to be a co-producer too. He could have co-produced, but we couldn't get him to the studio to sing, much less to produce. Vince is one of those guys who you can't push too hard. If he does show up and he happens to do something and it happens to be good, well, you get what you get.
Was Pamela Anderson around during the recording?
Well, we all went through some really good times with Pamela and some really shitty times with Pamela during the recording of that album. She used to do this thing every Friday where she'd come by the studio with a bottle of vodka. She'd say, "Okay, it's Friday. You guys are getting drunk." She insisted that Tommy get shit-faced every Friday. Then fast forward a few months, and she's on Jay Leno saying, "My husband's an alcoholic." I was just thinking, what is she talking about?
So what was going on in your mind during this whole recording process? Were you thinking, get me out of this nightmare?
It was really hard because when it was convenient, I had two co-producers. When it wasn't, I was on my own doing all the work. In the end, I went out screaming. I'll never forget this because my mother was sitting beside me at Christmas time, and I was talking to Nikki on the phone. I was saying, "If you don't come up with a better first single, your career is finished, and 6 months from now, you are going to blame it all on me." And he goes, "No, I know exactly what I'm doing, and I'm doing the right thing, and this is the perfect first single." At that point, I was sure that the reunited Motley Crue wasn't going to blow up just because the material wasn't good. If they had the right record, they could have easily gone double or triple platinum.
So you decided to wash your hands of it all?
What else could I do? You get tired of constantly saying no, 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 and arguing with people all the time. When the first single stiffed, I got a call from Nikki who said, "I think we released the wrong single." "You fucking asshole," I screamed at him. It didn't matter anyway, because by the time the album came out, Motley Crue had become celebrities on a scale they probably never could have imagined in their worst nightmares. It was really strange to me because all of a sudden, their personal lives became more important than their music.
Part 11. The Guns, the Women, the Ego. Chapter 1. Tommy. The maddening tale of the fork and the dishwasher is related. I thought she was the funniest girl on the planet. She should have been a comedian. She was nonstop action, talking faster than any girl I knew. Basically, she was a maniac, and I fucking flipped out over her. The first night we spent together was during time off from the Karabi tour. She lived in Reseda with her daughter Taylor from her marriage to Warrant singer Janie Lane. I remember seeing the video for Cherry Pie and thinking she was the hottest chick on wheels. She had perfect blonde hair, huge doe eyes, big glossy lips, and huge tits. Who cared whether it was all real or not? Her name was Bobby Brown, and she stole my heart the second she opened her mouth. I was sleeping in her bed after our first date at about 4 in the morning, and all of a sudden the frame started shaking. I had no idea what was going on. At first I thought it was some kind of crazy dream, then I thought some dude was trying to break in. As I slowly returned to consciousness, I realized the whole house was just pounding. We lay naked in her bed, not sure what to do, when suddenly her armoire came crashing to the ground, shattering the screen of her TV into a thousand little pieces. "Taylor!" Bobby suddenly cried. Her daughter was alone on the other side of the house, and who knew what was going on there? We slithered off the bed and dropped to the ground, almost shitting in our pants. We pushed open the door and went into the hallway. Everything was falling onto the floor, and the house was shaking so badly we kept getting thrown against the walls as we tried to crawl. The closer we came to Taylor's door, the more the house rattled, until it seemed like it was about to just fucking collapse. As we reached her room, I looked behind me and the whole house ripped apart. The kitchen and the living room just completely split off and disappeared, leaving a gaping hole of darkness. I was sure we were going to die. Taylor was on the floor, crying as the earthquake tossed her around the room. I grabbed her and yelled, "Fuck, let's go for it!" Then Bobby and I ran out of the room and toward the front door, careful not to get thrown onto the open side of the house and whatever abyss was waiting below. The front door was gone, so we ran through the space where it used to be and into the street. Outside, the earth slowed to a tremble, and we joined her neighbors, who were crying over the remains of their homes. After a first date like that, there was no going back. Bobby and Taylor moved into my pad on the beach, and after 6 months of partying together, I slipped a $15,000 engagement ring onto the top of a brownie she had ordered in a diner, then got down on my knees and asked her to marry me. She said yes, and that was when everything started to go downhill. But it rolled downhill slowly, so slowly that I hardly even noticed it. Scott Humphrey was over one day listening to some music I was writing, and Bobby snapped at me because I hadn't washed the hair out of the sink after I shaved or something. "Hey, dude," Scott said. Do you let her talk to you like that? What do you mean? I asked him. She's not even treating you like a human being. Is she always like this? Well, yeah, I said. And all of a sudden, those love blinders came off, and I started to notice things I never had before. Things about her just seemed off. She'd sneak around the house, hide things from me, disappear on strange errands, receive phone calls from guys I didn't know, and when I woke up in the morning, she usually wouldn't be in bed. Now, any other guy would think she was cheating on him, but I knew Bobby better than that. With the love goggles off, I also noticed that she was wasting away, and she was always fucking cranky. Sometimes I would come home from tour or the studio, and she'd be sitting on the floor with all these arts and crafts spread around her. She'd be hot gluing fruits and flowers together or covering a bowl of potpourri with gold spray paint. The next time I was alone with one of her friends, I asked her, "Dude, is Bobby doing fucking speed?" "I'm not gonna answer that," she said. "But why don't you look in her purse or check her makeup bag? And remember, we never spoke." Sure enough, I grabbed her purse and found fucking speed in there. It made everything in our relationship seem like bullshit, and it explained the crazy random mood swings that I was always a victim of. When I confronted her, she denied it at first. Then she attacked me for drinking, then she blamed it on me. The end result was a huge fucking fight that ended with me sleeping on the floor like a dog. After that, all this deep-seated resentment that had been building up in Bobby started to pour out daily. Everything I'd begun thinking about her, she had simultaneously been thinking about me. She felt that I was the one going through mood swings, that I'd become cranky, suspicious, and miserable to live with, and that I was sneaking around behind her back, not with drugs, but with other women. She was especially mad because she felt like I had asked her to give up her acting and modeling career because I was so scarred from my marriage with Heather and wanted children and a full-time wife. After a while, whenever Heather called because we had remained friends, Bobby would freak her shit. And whenever a guy called for her, I'd flip out. A few days before Christmas, when I wanted to go out to a holiday party, our mutual jealousies and mistrust exploded in an ugly, out-of-hand fight in front of Taylor. We were fighting every day by then, and that couldn't have been good for Taylor's development, let alone mine. I tried to think of a single reason why she should stay in my life, and I couldn't think of one. Even her sense of humor, which I had originally loved about her, had disappeared as our relationship became all about negativity and accusations. When I asked her to leave, she threw a fit and said she wasn't going anywhere without her clothing and furniture and shit. "You know what?" I told her. "You can have your stuff when you give me back my engagement ring, because we ain't getting fucking married. That's for damn sure." "Drop dead," she spat, adding about 100 rapid-fire oaths on top of it. "Well then, you ain't getting your shit." And with that, I grabbed her and marched her to the door. Strangely, I didn't have to force her. She went a little too willingly, it seemed. I was surprised that she didn't put up more of a fight, because she was a fucking fighter. An hour later, there was a loud knocking on my front door. I looked at the security monitor, and she was standing there with the fucking cops. I figured the cops would be fair since the house was mine and